Good day.
Today is Thursday, 23rd July 2023. And before I proceed with this programme, let me just explain that I have been actually quite unwell over the last 24 hours. As those of you who have been watching my programmes carefully will have noticed that my voice has been distorted. Briefly, I caught yet another infection from one of my three daughters. It's been with me for all of the last week. It has not prevented me from making programs until late in the afternoon of yesterday, when fevers began, and the fevers continued right through yesterday and for the first half of today with the intensity of a prairie fire. They appear now to have burnt themselves out, and I expect that I'm now fully on the mend. Well, anyone who has children knows that this is part of having children. They catch infections and they pass them on. Anyway, the effect of this is that I am making my program later today than usual. And since I am, as you can imagine, rather tired, likely it is going to be a shorter video than usual. Hopefully by tomorrow I will be sufficiently recovered that things will be back to normal. Anyway, thank you for your patience. And as you can still, no doubt still hear, my voice remains a little distorted even as I'm making this programme now. Now, I'm going to start this programme with a discussion of the meeting in Manila between the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio and the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Now, that meeting came out of nowhere. Suddenly, we learnt that Marco Rubio was talking about a meeting. There was a response from Lavrov, which I'll come to in a moment, and that the meeting took place on the sidelines of the ASEAN meeting in Manila, to which both Rubio and Lavrov had been invited. The Russians have made it very clear that it was the Americans who initiated the meeting. This has been clearly said by the Russian news agency TASS. So I want to make this point specifically because I know that some parts of independent media are claiming that this meeting happened on the Russian initiative. It was the Americans, the State Department, that asked for the meeting between Rubio and Lavrov in Manila. And the meeting duly took place, and it lasted all of 35 minutes, which is an impossibly short time for a meeting between foreign ministers of superpowers. When a meeting is as short as that, it suggests that little business was done, or that the parties exchanged ideas about one very specific point, and that whatever it was that they said to each other, no consensus was reached, and that the meeting overall was unsuccessful. So, what exactly happened? Now, before the meeting, Rubio justified the meeting by saying that Russia and the United States are the two world's greatest nuclear powers, which is true, and that it is important that the two greatest nuclear powers talk to each other, which is also true, and that even though they don't always agree with each other about everything, some sort of dialogue with each other is necessary, which is, I would say, true as well. But then meetings can take place at various levels, and such a short meeting doesn't seem to me to have been sufficiently long to cover the full range of Russian-US relations. Now, there is, I think, one clue to what this meeting was probably about. A report has appeared in Reuters that during the fighting between the United States and Iran in March, certain facilities in the Persian Gulf area were attacked by Iranian drones, and that the United States now believes that Russia had a hand in this attack, that it facilitated these attacks, and that some sort of investigation is underway. And this is happening, this report appeared after a drumbeat of further reports over the last couple of days, telling us about American dismay at the incredible accuracy of Iranian ballistic missiles, the fact that these ballistic missiles are able to undertake complex maneuvers before striking targets, which makes them almost impossible to shoot down, the fact that the Iranians seem to have a complete picture of where American assets are located at any one time, and claims that the Iranians must be obtaining assistance from the Russians and from the Chinese in order to be able to conduct strikes with such accuracy. And for the record, I believe that this is true. I've said this over many programs. I said that I had received information back in March that the Russians have indeed provided significant technical assistance to Iran. And I have also mentioned in previous programs that before the American attack on Iran on the 28th of February, I had already received reports from an extremely reliable source that the Russians have indeed been helping the Iranians improve the accuracy of their missiles, and this work started in earnest after the joint American-Israeli attack on Iran in June of last year. So I believe these reports that the Russians are helping the Iranians. After all, as I have also pointed out in many programs, at the time when the United States and the French and the British first floated ideas of supplying Ukraine with long-range missiles capable of striking inside Russia in the spring of 2024, the Russians warned that if such a thing were ever to happen, it would be the crossing of a red line. And as I very well remember, the Russians even called in the British and French ambassadors and warned them directly that if such a step was ever taken, the Russians would feel free to retaliate against British and French military sites anywhere in the world. And I have no doubt that the same warning was communicated through other channels directly to the United States. The Western powers ignored these warnings. They supplied missiles to Ukraine. The missiles, 500 ATACMS and an unknown number of Storm Shadows and Scalp missiles, were used to conduct strikes inside Russia. And last year, in the late spring, early summer of last year, reports appeared that President Trump of the United States had urged the Ukrainians to start attacks of their own against Moscow. And we received further reports a few weeks ago in the US media that in the autumn of 2025, the United States began a major campaign of assisting Ukraine with its drone offensive deep inside Russia, and that this was authorized by the President of the United States himself, by Donald Trump. And well, we have seen that offensive play out over the last few months. And, well, after confirmation that this meeting with Rubio would take place, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, himself made a strong statement in which he said that criticism of Russia for providing assistance to Iran was doubly misplaced. Doubly misplaced because, firstly, the Russians are not, in fact, providing military assistance to Iran. And secondly, because the United States is providing to Ukraine exactly the type of military assistance that it is complaining the Russians are providing to Iran. The United States is providing long-range weapons to Ukraine, with which Ukraine is conducting drone strikes with American assistance, with American satellite and other assistance upon Russia. So, a defiant statement from Lavrov, which strongly suggests to me that Lavrov expected that when the meeting with Rubio took place in Manila, the Americans would bring up this topic of Russian assistance to Iran. And it makes sense. It makes complete sense in terms of what is now happening in the Middle East. Because as virtually every commentator now acknowledges, the US military campaign against Iran is not going well. American bases and facilities across the Middle East, across the Persian Gulf area, have been attacked. The Americans have had to pull back their forces to Jordan. However, their Jordanian bases are also being attacked. There are reports that they're going to pull back further still towards Israel itself. But, of course, we saw in March and in June of last year that the Iranians do have the capabilities to launch missile strikes against targets in Israel too. So if the Americans believe, rightly or wrongly, that the Russians are assisting Iran, given that the pressure on the United States is on, given that the United States, some people in the United States may feel that the United States is losing the confrontation with Iran, given that the Strait of Hormuz is closed, given that the Red Sea, apparently the Red Sea route, is now also closed. There have been reports of attacks by the Houthis on Saudi tankers. Given that the price of oil, this is the headline price of oil, has now risen to $100 a barrel. Given that there are major shortages of aviation fuel and diesel fuel. And given that there are also multiple reports about the reserves of oil in the United States becoming severely depleted. Is it not understandable that the United States might be anxious to speak to the Russians, the people who the US may believe, rightly or wrongly, are the source of all the problems in the Persian Gulf? And that they might have anxiously and urgently convened this meeting with Lavrov in Manila to discuss this very topic. Now, if this is what has happened, and basically I think it is, then that explains the short meeting, the short time of the meeting. Because the Russians came to Manila straightforwardly denying that they are providing any assistance to Iran at all. As it happens here, I don't believe that the Russians are telling the truth. Now, I've not been told this. I've no information about this I should make clear from anyone in Russia. When I was in Russia a month ago, nobody told me privately, you know, we are actually providing assistance to Iran. But I did see, whilst I was in Russia, that there are considerable interactions between Russia and Iran, though the only ones I know about were between civilians, just to make that clear. But I did receive those reports from a reliable source, about whom I'm going to say nothing, before the start of the conflict between the United States and Iran, of Russian help to Iran. And I also believe, and I've also received information, that it was indeed the Russians who provided the Iranians with the technology the Iranians used to jam the Starlink system during the January protests. So, I think that on this, the Russians are lying. They're simply engaging in the well-known game of plausible deniability. And of course, that means that the Russians are not going to ramp down their support for Iran. Doing so at this time would, of course, create trouble between the Russians and the Iranians. And I don't think the Russians want to have any trouble with the Iranians. And besides, the Russians would know that if there were some sort of informal quid pro quo between themselves and the Americans about ceasing assistance by each superpower to the ally or proxy of the other, Iran or Ukraine, to carry out deep strikes, that the Americans almost certainly would not honour that informal bargain, that attacks deep inside Russia would nonetheless still continue. So I think that the Russians, when they met with Rubio, when Lavrov met with Rubio in Manila, they stonewalled. And they stonewalled on whatever other topic the Americans brought up, like the overall situation in the Middle East, diplomatic initiatives to end the conflict there, and of course, diplomatic measures to end the conflict in Ukraine as well. Now, an article has appeared in Bloomberg which says that the Russians, that President Putin has walked back the territorial concessions he made to the Americans, to Donald Trump, at the summit meeting in Anchorage. Now, we have never been told what those concessions actually were. We know that some concessions were made because the Russians have told us that they made some concessions. And President Trump, as I very well remember, at the time of the summit meeting and after, spoke about land swaps. Now, the Bloomberg article suggests that land swaps were that the Russians agreed to pull out of Kharkiv and Sumy regions, and in return, that the Ukrainians pull out of Donbass. There is no reference in the Bloomberg articles to Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, which does make me wonder whether, in fact, the various reports that the Russians agreed to a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions might be wrong. I don't know. But anyway, it seems that the Russians, according to Bloomberg at least, have communicated to the Americans that they are no longer prepared to give up the territory that they have captured in Kharkiv and Sumy region to the Ukrainians. They continue to insist on their right to retain this territory as a buffer zone. So the original land swap ideas, as supposedly discussed, as discussed by Donald Trump after the Anchorage meeting, that idea appears to be dead. Now, Putin's spokesman, Peskov, was asked to comment about this article in Bloomberg, and he said that the Ukrainians know exactly what they need to do in order to bring the war to an end. It was all set out by President Putin at his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June, 2024. What Putin set out to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June, 2024, is what I call Istanbul Plus, which requires the Ukrainians not just to retreat from Donbass, from Donetsk and Lugansk, but also from Zaporozhye and Kherson as well. So it looks as if, for the moment, the Russians have gone back to the original Istanbul demands, the Istanbul Plus demands of 14th of June 2024. Whatever concessions they made, whatever retreat from those demands that they made at the Anchorage summit, they have now put behind them. They have said to the Americans, Anchorage didn't work. The proposals the United States made have not been honored, so we are no longer prepared to make the concessions that we said we would. Now, this is consistent with what Putin said to Trump back in December 2025 on the day of the Ukrainian drone attack on Novgorod, which the Russians believe was an attack on Putin's Valdai residence and was in fact an assassination attempt on him. And Putin, who had been asked to stay by the f on the phone by the phone by Trump after they'd first spoken, and who probably wasn't, as it happens, in Valdai, but who have ever since, as a result, who has ever since, as a result, and the Russians ever since, as a result, have believed that Trump, or at least the Americans themselves, were in some way involved, implicated in this assassination attempt. Anyway, when Trump did call back, Putin mentioned that there'd been this drone attack on Valdai, and he told Trump that in light of that attack, certain concessions that he had made in Anchorage were likely to be withdrawn. So the Russians gave the Americans notice that this was going to happen. And if the Bloomberg article is correct, it has indeed now happened. So, anyway, the result is that if Rubio was looking to make diplomatic progress on settling the Ukrainian conflict with the Russians, he would have found Lavrov again, stonewalling, and that also no doubt explains the failure of the meeting. The Americans with the Russians on Ukraine are back to square one. So I devoted a certain amount of time to this meeting. To me, it highlights again the extent to which negotiations, both on the Iranian conflict and on the Ukrainian conflict, are now at a standstill. And the way that this is playing out, which is to say it simply, not to the United States' advantage. The United States had a very good deal on the table in Anchorage. If they'd built on it, they'd have had to face down their European allies. But ultimately, they could have done that. And they could have put Zelensky in his place. They could probably ultimately even have replaced him if he proved intransigent. But it would have preserved Ukraine. And, well, it would have resolved the immediate conflict with the Russians in Europe, which is a major drain on American resources. Instead of following through on Anchorage, they went on an extraordinary tangent. They imposed sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil. They threatened the Russians with Tomahawk missiles. They involved themselves in this drone offensive against the Russians. And they have reverted in recent weeks to talking about a ceasefire on the existing conflict lines, which the Russians have rejected. And the result is that the Russians are now continuing their advance and are now within visible distance of wrapping up the battle of Donbass and have probably ramped up their support for Iran in the meantime. And as I discussed in previous programs, in my opinion, the MOU, the terms of the MOU, were ultimately beneficial for the United States, extricating the United States from an impossible situation in the Persian Gulf. But instead of honouring the terms of the MOU and moving purposefully forward with negotiations, the United States has drifted back into war with the results that we have seen. All of this illustrates yet again both the malign influence of the neocons on US foreign policy, who have, as Alex Cristoforo and I have repeatedly said, no reverse gear, and what the effect of that is, in both cases, a car crash. Anyway, let's now turn to other matters and let's look at the situation in Ukraine. We had yesterday the first full confirmation that the Russian attacks on Odessa and on the ports of Odessa are achieving their intended purpose, which is a complete sea blockade of Odessa and a total closure of Ukraine's Black Sea ports. Maersk, one of the biggest ship-owning companies in the world, is Danish, have announced that they are no longer prepared to send ships to Odessa. It has become much too dangerous. They're going to send ships with cargoes that had originally been intended for Odessa to the port of Constanța in Romania instead. But, of course, Constanța is located a significant distance from Odessa. The Russians will be tracking everything that goes into Constanța. The facilities at Constanța are not as developed, from my knowledge, as those that used to exist in Odessa, both for export and for import. And of course, Constanța is anyway a busy port. So this is a major economic blow for Ukraine. I have no doubt that where Maersk has led, other ship owners will follow. So Odessa is now closed, and I predict it will remain so for the duration of the conflict, with serious effects on Ukraine's economy and, by the way, on its military logistics system. The Russian attacks, by the way, on Odessa continue at the same level of intensity as always. The Russians have also made further advances on the Ukrainian battlefronts. Now, since this is going to be a shorter video than usual, I am not going to go through all of the advances that the Russians have achieved. It's starting to look as if in Kharkiv region, we are looking at the early stages of a major Russian breakthrough, just saying. But elsewhere on the battlefronts, the Russians today announced the capture of Belitska. This is a small town to the north of Pokrovsk. North of Pokrovsk, in fact, there were two towns, Rodinska and Belitska. The Russians claimed to have captured Rodinska a few months ago. The Ukrainians, by the way, deny this. They still insist that they have a presence in Rodinska, but I am sure that is wrong. And then a very intense battle for Belitsko followed, but the Russians today say that the entire town is under their control, though they also say that there are some Ukrainian troops still in Belitsko, hiding in the basements of buildings, and that a mopping up operation to smoke all of these troops out, these Ukrainian troops, is underway. Now, this announcement of the fall of Belitsko has come a few hours after other reports appeared that the Russians have achieved some major breakthrough in the Dobropilia area and are about to storm the city of Dobropilia, the town of Dobropilia, which is a sizable place. I mean, it's not as big as some of the other places, but it's a town, it's not a village. Anyway, that the Russians are now in the process of capturing Dobropilia and have broken through into the town, and that fighting is taking place inside the town itself. The fall of Dobropilia will be a disaster for Ukraine, and the capture by the Russians of Belitskaya makes the fall of Dobropilia, well, it brings it forward faster. Dobropilia is located to the west of the Slavyansk Kramatorsk conurbation. It begins to seal the emerging cauldron within of the Ukrainian army that is located there. And Dobropilia also provides the Russians with operational space. It is the very western edge of the Donbass. Beyond Dobropilia, it is fields, open country, basically, all the way to the Dnieper River. In theory, the Russians could advance towards cities like Pavlograd and Kharkiv without encountering any fortified positions or major urban obstacles. So the fall of Dobropilia, if it comes, which it will, is a major event in the war. Now, the Russians continued their strikes on Ukraine, and the Ukrainians continued their strikes on Russia. The Ukrainians, by the way, attacked another merchant ship, another tanker in the Black Sea, and they launched another big drone strike on southern Russia. And this drone strike did hit two oil facilities and did damage one refinery. I've spoken about how it appeared that Ukrainian refinery attacks had ceased, but last night we got a renewed one. Maybe there was some gap in the Russian air defense system in southern Russia that the Ukrainians took advantage of. Who knows? But to repeat again, all of these attacks cannot compare with the situation in Ukraine itself, with the massive attacks that the Russians have been carrying out over the last few weeks against Odessa, the fact that Ukraine's Black Sea coast is now in effect closed. I've been saying, by the way, for years that if the Russians put their minds to it, they could completely blockade Odessa and the whole Ukrainian Black Sea coast, and that all of the stories about Ukraine having achieved some great naval victory in the Black Sea were nonsense. And well, we see how it has turned out exactly that way. And well, the Russians continue to attack and destroy gas filling stations and other plants, other facilities across eastern and central Ukraine. And inevitably, rumors are circulating about another massive Russian strike against Kiev being prepared. And well, we haven't seen for a while use of the Oreshnik system. We'll see whether at some point that starts to be used. I expect it will be, but perhaps later over the course of the next few months. Now, just to finish this brief run up of the situation, rundown of the situation, the Russians are now clearly talking about a cauldron of Ukrainian troops that they have managed to achieve in the Liman area. They say that they control all the crossing points on the Seversky-Donetsk River and that a Ukrainian force is indeed trapped. And the Russians are using the word trapped, and I'm taking this from the Russian Defense Ministry's own version of events. And the Russians also say that they are in the process of capturing a village in Sumy region, which will close one of the main roads leading into Sumy, complicating the supply situation in that town. The new Ukrainian military commander, General Drapaty, contrary to what his predecessor, General Sirski, said, is inheriting a terrible situation. Anyway, that's the situation on the battle lines. Now, yesterday, and well, rather, I think it was actually today, the European Union finally agreed its 21st sanctions package. And well, this was a hodgepodge of decisions, and all sorts of countries, EU states, were able to carve out exemptions to benefit their industries. So the Greeks were able to carve out a exemption so that Greek ships can continue to carry liquefied natural gas from Russian Arctic ports for supply to third countries. This supposedly will continue for a year, but it can be renewed beyond that. There's been all sorts of other carve-outs negotiated by other countries and all sorts of things like fisheries and things of that kind. There is an agreement, there was an agreement to reduce the price cap on Russian oil to $44. This at a time when the price of oil is rising and is now the headline price is at $100 a barrel. Again, it's difficult to understand what planet the Europeans are on if they really think that Russian oil is going to trade at just $44 a barrel at a time of a global shortage of oil. Just saying. And well, there are many more sanctions against individuals and Russian companies. I don't yet have any details about that, but obviously none of that is going to make the Russians change course or change their decisions in any way. I don't understand why the European Union feels that it must come up with more and more sanctions packages. 21 sanctions packages now. I mean, it imposed very tough sanctions on Russia back in February and March 2022. A strong and coherent position would have been to stick with those until perhaps the Russians changed course. Perhaps every so often a decision might have been made to tighten some sanctions in some places. But introducing a new sanctions package in this monotonous, regular way, as my friend Ian Proud rightly said in his recent article on his Substack site, The Peacemonger, implies that sanctions now have a idea, a principle of their own. They're just being implemented because that is what the European Union basically now does. Well, it's not going to change the situation in the war. The latest word is that President Trump himself is intent on watering down Lindsey Graham's bone-crushing sanctions, and that he thinks it's going to be easier to do now that Lindsey Graham himself is dead, and that he insists that he, Trump, will have the right to both impose and waive the sanctions at his own discretion. That, of course, is something he has been insisting on ever since the bone-crushing sanctions bill was first proposed by Richard Blumenthal and Lindsey Graham in the summer of last year, at a time when energy markets were far more stable than they are today. So the Americans are going one direction on the sanctions, but the Europeans persist in going in the opposite direction in the sanctions. None of this changes the overall military realities. The war continues. The Russians are now uncompromising and stonewalling the Americans as well as the Europeans. It's difficult to see that there's going to be any diplomatic movement until, at the very least, the whole of Donbass has fallen, at which point I still expect Putin to come out and make a statement, quite plausibly raising Russian demands. But for the moment, it's all war and nothing else. Well, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. Hopefully, a longer video tomorrow.